What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping you?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. Glad you could join us on this Tuesday afternoon. This program is just for you if you are a non-Catholic trying to get an answer about why does the Catholic Church teach this, but they don't teach this over here. Here's our phone number to get those questions answered. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also shoot us an email if you prefer that. The address is ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles, our producer, Matt Kabinski, our phone screener, Rich Jesse handling social media for us. If you have a question and you're watching us on YouTube today, or if you're watching us on Facebook, you can put that question in the comments box if you would, and then we'll see it. We'll hopefully get that answered on today's program. Again, the phone number 833-288-EWTN. I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
You know what? I'm doing great. Today is your day.
It's my day?
Your buddy, St. Thomas Aquinas.
Oh, that's right. That's today, isn't it?
Today is the day.
Well, St. Thomas, pray for us.
Why is St. Thomas Aquinas a big deal for not only Catholics, but for everybody?
Thomas he's called the common doctor of the Catholic Church, meaning that he's a safe authority on almost every topic. He's commented on everything, and his way of doing theology, the way he construes the relationship of faith and reason, the Church says that's the model for how you do theology. It doesn't mean every conclusion he drew was correct, but he had the right approach. He thought through the thing with the right big picture, and he was just such a fantastic thinker and a systematic thinker that he's not the last word in Catholic theology, but in some respects he's the first word and one of the most important words.
Even Dr. Martin Luther King quoted Thomas Aquinas.
He absolutely did, in defense of the doctrine of natural law, which was what lay behind King's letter to the Birmingham jail.
Yeah, absolutely.
Letter from the Birmingham jail, I should say.
Very good. So, St. Thomas Aquinas, pray for us. We received a phone call overnight on the EWTN listener comment line to share with you.
Hi, my name is Ethan from Washington State, and I'm calling trying to learn about cremation. I recognize the church's teaching is that it's okay, that's kind of recent, and I don't know, I just want to talk about it in terms of the resurrection of the body and what that means. So just wondering about cremation. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Ethan. I really appreciate the question. Well, you've put your finger on the key point here, which is the doctrine of the resurrection, and more specifically, the dignity of the body, which is why the body is raised.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually does put a limit on the manner and reasons that one may be cremated. So you're correct, the Church allows cremation, but not every cremation or for any reason. And the Church specifies that if cremation be undertaken for, quote, a superstitious reason, unquote, then it is not lawful. So what would a superstitious reason be? Well, let's say someone wants to be cremated and have their ashes spread over the great Smoky Mountain National Forest or something, because they love the Smoky Mountains and they want their spirit to be diffused, I don't know, among all the black bears or something. You have some kind of new agey conception of what happens to the human soul. That'd be a superstitious reason to be cremated, okay? Let's say someone wants to be cremated and have their ashes dumped in the Ganges River because they think that will help them acquire positive karma or something for their next incarnation. That, again, would be a superstitious reason. Let's say the reason is I can't afford to be buried in a traditional cemetery, and I like the thought of my remains being kept intact in the columbarium at my Catholic church, where I know my relatives go on a regular basis to Mass and they can pray for the repose of my soul. That would be an appropriate reason to have a cremation, and so the church would allow the one but not those others. Another thing would not be allowed would be someone may have Catholic faith in the dignity of the body, but then in fact want to be cremated and have their ashes divided up into so many thimbles passed out to all the relatives to put on their mantelpieces. You know, again, that's not a respectful way to care for the remains of the dead. And so the church says no to that, has to be kept intact in a designated place set aside for that sort of purpose, like a columbarium or a cemetery.
Oh, very good. Ethan, thanks so much for your call to our EWTN listener comment line. Here's a question from T.O. in Houston, who texted us yesterday. How can Catholics fully understand immigration issues that seem to contradict the Vatican and the White House? Can we reference it in the scriptures as well as the teachings of our saints and fathers?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So I think the best way to go about understanding the morality and the social ethics on immigration is to follow the teaching of the Catholic Church, especially the Church's social doctrine. There's a wonderful document called the Compendium of the Social Doctrine of the Catholic Church that lays out in a systematic way, here's what the Church teaches on social issues, including those related to immigration.
Okay.
And, of course, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has issued a lot of communication specifically about the immigration situation in the United States. And that's where I would take my cues from. You know, there are some principles in Holy Scripture, namely and especially the value of caring for the alien and the widow and the stranger among us. I mean, the Pentateuch is quite clear that Israel had an obligation to look out for aliens and strangers because, as the text said, you yourselves were aliens and strangers once. And not everybody, but for most of us that live in North America, our, if not us directly, our sometimes our immediate ancestors, or at most a few generations back, were also aliens and strangers and pilgrims to this land.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I mean that we have to have empathy and understand that. Now, you know, there are other principles about national sovereignty and the rule of law that the Church also recognizes. So when it comes to making the specific policy application, one thing I would want to guard against as a Catholic is just in a kind of knee-jerk way assuming that the political party that best suits my own personal ideology is just obviously the best implementation of the Church's social doctrine. And the Church doesn't roll that way. It doesn't say, you know, that social doctrine is reducible to a political ideology, and generally ideologies and political parties will get at least some aspect of it wrong, right? But you hold the ideal out, and then you hold your policymakers accountable, whatever their political party, to implement that vision as closely as possible.
Tio, thank you for your text. In a moment, we'll talk with Rose Marie in Michigan. Lines are open for you at 833-288-EWTN for Call to Communion. Stay with us. It's Call to Communion on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. I'm so glad that you're with us today. Here's our phone number if you have a question for David Anders, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. We'll get to Rose Marie in just a moment here. Have you checked out Church Pop lately? Church Pop takes a fresh and fun look at the news shaping our world, featuring engaging, inspiring, informative Catholic social media. Find it on Snapchat, on Instagram, and on the web at churchpop.com. You can also get Church Pop content directly to your email inbox. Visit EWTN.com and click subscribe. All right, if you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Rose Marie in Michigan was our last caller of the day yesterday. Couldn't get to Rose Marie then, but we certainly can now. I'm glad you called back, Rose Marie. What's on your mind today?
Thank you for taking my call. I when we say the Apostles' Creed, and then we say that Jesus descended into hell, and on the third day he rose from the dead, why did he go into hell? And I was taught as a little girl that hell was the purpose for Jesus to go and straighten out the devil down there, and to take, on the third day, he took the people from the purgatory and rose with him. Is that correct?
Yeah, I really appreciate the question. Thank you so much. So it's important to distinguish when we say in the Creed that Christ descended to hell, we're not talking about the hell of the damned. Christ doesn't experience damnation. But the church teaches that before the coming of Christ, the righteous dead of the Old Covenant, like Moses and Isaiah and all those characters from the Old Testament, had not yet been admitted to the beatific vision, but they weren't in the hell of the damned either, and they didn't necessarily need to be in purgatory, so they were in a kind of holding tank, as it were, until the Messiah came, and Christ goes and liberates those souls. And so you got that part of the story right. It wasn't purgatory from which he removed them, but something that the church calls the limbus of the fathers that doesn't exist anymore because they, of course, ascended to heaven.
Okay. Rosemary, thanks so much for your call. And that opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to Communion on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN Radio. Let's go to Laura now. Laura is in Washington, listening online, EWTN.com. Hey, Laura, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, or morning for us, probably afternoon for you.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I explained to your screener that my daughter will be getting married in August, and her fiancé, I love them both very dearly. They're good people. And she has chosen to get married in an outdoor wedding at a venue where they're asking his good friend to be the officiant. And he's gone through an online course to have it done. And my question is, I love them both dearly. And my daughter and I are very close, and I want to give them my blessing. I want to be there for them, for the ceremony and all. I'm planning the reception with her that is after the wedding. Have not partaken in planning at all the wedding service itself, just because I wanted to hold off. I'm a very active Catholic, I love the church, and I want to honor what the church is and who the church is. Kind of in a quandary right now, how much of a blessing and a go ahead, go for it kind of attitude, or
right.
You know,
I totally understand. So I have a couple questions for you, Laura. First of all, I'm assuming that your daughter was baptized and confirmed as a Catholic.
Very much. She and my son both were.
Okay. Uh-huh. So in this instance, it's your daughter, right? Your daughter and son-in-law. Is that what you said?
Correct.
Okay.
Well, future son-in-law.
Future son-in-law. Right. Of course. This wedding will not create a valid marriage in the eyes of the church. It'll be invalid. And because she's Catholic, in order for her to be married outside of the church, validly, she would need a dispensation from her bishop. And I have a very sneaky suspicion that she has not requested such a dispensation and would likely not be granted one for these reasons. So it's not valid. Now, the fact that she's chosen to do this, I'm assuming also means that she doesn't really give a fig about whether or not the church considers her marriage to be valid. I mean, is that a reasonable supposition on my part to make?
Well, that's a little harsh. She honors her upbringing, but she just chooses not to honor it anymore. Yes.
All right. I didn't mean to be disrespectful. I'm sorry. I apologize. That wasn't my intent. Sometimes I speak a little bit too colloquially. but basically, it's not a priority for her, right? It's not a priority for her to have a valid wedding in the eyes of the Catholic Church. So I'm also guessing that she would be kind of immune to reasons to the contrary. Like if you said to her, you know, this is not going to be a valid wedding, therefore you shouldn't go through with it, or you should have a priest bless your wedding or whatever, that she's probably not going to listen to that. Would that also be your position?
Well, yes, we have the conversation several times I have with both of them, and I just have expressed my wish that they could get married in the church, and I would be willing to walk with them side by side to have that done.
Okay.
And her to be, you know, reintroduced into the church, and him to be for the first time.
Okay. All right. So those are all of my questions, and that does kind of help clarify my answer. And again, I apologize for my loose use of language. I didn't mean any disrespect for your daughter or to you. Obviously I want to know if she's Catholic, because if she's not Catholic, if she weren't Catholic, then this could be a presumptively valid wedding, and it wouldn't be an issue, right? But the fact that she's Catholic means it'll be invalid. The reason I asked if she cares, right, is because if she were ignorant of her obligation, then the question of informing her of her Catholic obligations would be on the table, right? And the fact that that you have already done that and she's persisted means you've kind of done what you can do in that regard. And so now you're at a completely different stage, and that is you have to make a prudential choice about what is your best mode of approach in terms of relating to them going forward. And there are two issues here. One of them is the possibility of scandal, which would be if you support something that you know to be objectively wrong, do you lead somebody else into sin through your actions? And I think we've pretty well established here that you have signaled that you don't approve, and so the risk of scandal to your daughter and future son-in-law is negligible. It's not existent because you've already said, I'd rather you not do it this way. I'd rather you follow what the church teaches. You know, if there's somebody else in your life, a younger sibling or something that could be scandalized by your involvement, that's another thing to prudently consider. But then balanced against the possibility of scandal if you support it, there's also kind of a possibility of scandal if you don't. And here's what I mean by that the number of people who genuinely understand the rationale for the church's teaching is very small, particularly outside of Catholic land. And many people who leave the Catholic Church do so because they are under the impression that the Catholic Church is just a sort of nitpicking, sort of, overbearing authority that wants to impinge itself in every area of your life in minuscule and insignificant ways. And their view is, well, this is just the kind of reason that I left the Catholic Church to begin with, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And if you make a big stink about it and refuse to participate, then, you know, the odds that you alienate your daughter, your future son-in-law, and maybe other relatives down the road for long periods of time goes up, and it doesn't do much to reconcile them to the church. And so, you know, balancing all of those concerns, you know, my general sense, and this is just a prudent judgment on my part, and I could be wrong, is that your best course of action is to kind of do what you've already done, which is to say, here's what I really think you ought to do. You're going to go in a different direction, but I want you to know I love you anyway, and I want to be involved in your life. And so you've kind of let everybody know where you stand on the truth of the Catholic faith, but you've also let them know where you stand in terms of your commitment to them as people and your love for your daughter and for your future son-in-law. And you want that relationship that you hopefully can sustain for many years to be the basis, hopefully, of maybe reconciling with the church later on. So I kind of think you're on the right track here.
Laura, is that helpful for you?
Oh, tremendously. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thanks so much for your call. Let's stay on this topic of marriage and go to Chris, just outside of Boston, listening on the EWTN app. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind today, sir?
Yeah, hi, Dr. Anders. Thanks for taking the call. Just listening to your last explanation to Lauren, I think I'm kind of in the same boat.
Uh-huh.
I've been asked by a good friend to do their marriage to be essentially an online pastor, do that course, I guess she mentioned. I am a practicing Catholic. I do certainly know the importance of marriage in the church. And I'm just having a hard time discerning and thinking through it. So I'm not sure if there's anything else you can offer.
Yeah, I think there is. And I see the dilemma. Okay. It's kind of ironic to have these two calls back to back.
It is.
So I don't think it's an exact equivalent problem. I think it's a different issue altogether. So there are certainly situations, I believe, when a Catholic who is a Catholic in good faith and wants to be Orthodox and follow the teaching of the church could, in good conscience, preside over a non-Catholic valid wedding. And the occasion that comes to my mind most readily would be, say, a probate judge or a magistrate. There are many people in our culture who are not practicing Christians, who are not even baptized, who have the desire and the moral capability of being validly naturally married. I mean, the church teaches there is such a thing as natural marriage,
uh-huh,
and as a non-sacramental marriage. And natural marriages can be valid. And say two atheists, for example, that want to marry, they can do so. And the church recognizes the marriage of atheists as a valid marriage. It would be a natural marriage, not a sacramental one, but valid, right? And from the Catholic Church's point of view, the only thing that's necessary to achieve a valid natural marriage is the consent of the parties. So if two atheists say, I marry you and I marry you, and they mean more or less what the church means by marriage, then the church says, yeah, they're validly married. Now, in terms of civil law, are, you know, most states in the United States, well, all the ones that I know of, have some governing family law that governs marriage as a contract between parties. And so if you want that union to be recognized by the state for, you know, insurance and taxation purposes and inheritance rights and child custody and all the reasons that you would want that recognized, then you have to follow the rules in the state. And generally, those rules are going to require, you know, some kind of recognition by an official person like a magistrate or a probate judge or something like that. And that's a legitimate social function. And the church recognizes the value that civil governments have an interest, that the church has an interest in seeing civil governments recognize the institution of marriage as such. And so, you know, the Catholic Church collaborates and cooperates with civil governments in making sure that Catholic sacramental marriages, for example, are also recognized as valid secular marriages in the eyes of the state, right? And a kind of coordination between those two has always been part of the Catholic way of doing things. And so, you know, a Catholic judge, for example, could function as a probate or a magistrate, probate judge or a magistrate, and oversee those kinds of relationships. So I don't think there's anything in principle wrong with the Catholic adjudicating or officiating at a non-Catholic wedding under certain circumstances. Now, questions that I would want to ask are, you know, are these people, first of all, are they Catholics? If they're Catholics, then I would not do it, to be sure, because unless they've been given a dispensation by the bishop, it's not valid, and I don't want to formally cooperate with something the church says is wrong. All right, so I wouldn't do it if they're Catholic. Let's say they're Protestants. And they're practicing Protestants.
Okay.
Well, then I'd say the situation is a little more gray, because at least as far as the Catholic Church is concerned, the marriage of two Protestants is sacramental, doesn't have to be performed in front of a Catholic priest to be valid, because they're not Catholic.
Yeah.
But its sacramental character ideally ought to be represented in some kind of liturgical or quasi-liturgical or sacred sort of way, so that it's signaled to the minds of all the people involved that this is a kind of sacred institution of sacred value, and to totally secularize it would be a kind of injustice to the nature of the wedding as such. To the extent that it's possible, even non-Christian marriages ought to have a kind of sacral character if such a thing is possible. I think the only situation where I might say you can't aim for that would be, you know, if you have two completely secular, atheistic, materialistic humanists who are explicit in their rejection of any kind of sacred character to the institution, but otherwise recognize, you know, the lifelong union of a male and a man and a woman for the sake of raising a family as an institution worth preserving, that would be the basic definition of, you know, of marriage. Then under that kind of circumstance, well, maybe. But there's a lot of discernment that takes place in there, but those are kind of the parameters within which you have to think this thing through.
Chris, is that helpful for you, sir?
Yeah, it definitely is. You made a comment about dispensation from the bishop, and at least one party is Catholic and divorced.
Well, boom. Then that, so if you got a Catholic party, I would not do it.
Well, there you go. Chris, thanks so much for your call. We do appreciate that. In a moment, we're going to be talking with Dan, a first-time caller from Hastings, Nebraska. Also, Vince is a first-time caller in Phoenix, Arizona. Ken is in Portland. A couple lines open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Or you could shoot us an email if you prefer that, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. You could also text the letters EWTN to 58177. You'll get a quick robo response from us. When you get that, then just put in your, or text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. Again, our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. It's called a community. You with Dr. David Anders. Do stay with us. Hey, glad you're with us for Call to Communion on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. Two lines open for you, and it's not too late for you to call 833 833- 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Congratulations going out to another EWTN radio partner, WGIC, 94.9 FM, serving Clarksville, Tennessee. They are celebrating 8 years with EWTN. Congratulations to Lisa Meeks and everybody there at Immaculate Conception Parish. That's where the station is, from your friends here at EWTN Radio. All right, back to the phones now. Here's Dan in Hastings, Nebraska, listening on the Great Spirit Catholic Radio. Hello, Dan. What's on your mind today?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Listening to the beginning of the program, you had a question about ashes being spread after a cremation. Well, my father was a Protestant, and he was very religious, but when he told me what he wanted to have done with his ashes was he wanted them spread at the geographical center of the continental United States. So, because he traveled a lot. Uh-huh. Now, by participating in this, I've often wondered if I was committing a sin because that was his wishes and he wasn't Catholic, or, I mean, is this something that it's always been bothered me that I thought I was doing something wrong by doing that or not?
Yeah, I really appreciate the question. So, I'm not a priest and I can't give absolution, but I want to say in a very colloquial way, I absolve you of guilt in this matter, right? You do not need this. That has no sacramental significance whatsoever at all. But as far as psychologically is concerned, like, I don't hold that against you because I know where you were coming from and the kind of constraints you were under psychologically. So here are a couple of considerations. First of all, your dad wasn't Catholic and he was not subject to Catholic canon law. So the law about cremation applies to Catholics and doesn't apply to people who aren't Catholic. So, you know, the church doesn't really comment on a lot of things that that fall without its jurisdiction. And the burial rites of non-Catholics is one of the things that falls out of its jurisdiction, and it doesn't comment on them, right?
Yeah.
Unless they violate some, you know, sort of gross matter of human dignity or something.
Okay.
And then they would comment. Now, you know, I would say that if I'm trying to prudently discern whether to carry out that kind of a request, I mean, here are some of the things that I would go through, that would go through my mind in the moment. One would be, you know, well, what are the people around me going to think I'm doing? Right, because that raises the possibility of the sin of scandal. Mm-hmm. Right, am I scandalizing the people around me? You know, am I doing it myself for a superstitious reason? Like, you know, do I think Dad's going to come back from the grave and haunt me or something if I don't do his will? Well, that would be kind of a superstitious fear, and I wouldn't want to do it on that basis. You know, I think that you love your father. You want to honor his memory. You want to honor his wishes. Anybody would.
Yeah.
You know, the command to honor thy father and thy mother. A case can be made from sacred scripture that has as much to do with attending to proper burial rites as it does anything else that we might perform for our parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And honoring their wishes is an important part of honoring one's parents. And so, I see how you could feel like you were stuck between a rock and a hard place. And it doesn't seem to me, you know, that you violated any specific hard and fast norm. There are prudent concerns that I would raise about it, and I've already raised them. But, nothing, I think, where you need to beat yourself up over the head. You know, would you do the same thing again if asked by another parent? Maybe you'd decide differently. But, I mean, this is done and gone, and we know your heart was in the right place, and so I'd kind of give yourself a break and move on.
Appreciate your call, Dan. Thanks for calling in from Hastings, Nebraska, listening on the fabulous Spirit Catholic Radio. Call to communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Phoenix now and talk with Vince, listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey, Vince, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hey, good afternoon, and hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I like a little enlightenment on the rules of communion. A little background: I'm born, raised Catholic. Parents practice the faith. I practice the faith of my children, and it's the subject is more relevant today because I have two son-in-laws that are Christian, but they're not Catholic, and I'm always working on conversion and trying to get them into the fold. What I don't understand is if we believe in the power of the Eucharist, that is, that's the body and blood of Christ, can do infinite amount of good, why is the Catholic Church so adamant in not allowing non-Catholics receiving the Eucharist?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. What a fantastic question. There are lots of reasons for this, lots of reasons. So let's draw a distinction here between the objective elements of grace that are offered to us in the Catholic faith, whether that's through the Eucharist or any other sacrament or through the death of Christ or what have you. On the one hand, there's the sort of the objective element. On the other hand, there's the subjective application to the soul. Like, how do you actually go about getting that good into the individual? Okay. And it is absolutely the teaching of the Church that the way you get the grace of the sacrament into your soul through Holy Communion is not uniquely through eating it. Eating it's part, that's part of the sacramental action.
Yeah.
But that if you eat without the proper disposition, at best, you do yourself no good. At worst, you do yourself actual harm.
Hmm.
And let me unpack that a little bit. So, Protestants and Catholics have a different understanding of communion, and I don't just mean that, you know, one believes in the real presence and one doesn't. Actually, many Protestants do believe in the real presence. The difference goes even deeper than that. For many Protestants, the meaning of Holy Communion is that it signals, reminds us, evokes for us God's unconditional, unmerited favor. And so by going to Holy Communion, I remind myself, I kind of stir up in myself this recognition, this conception, this conviction that God accepts me for who I am, where I am, no matter what, as long as I have faith. And you'll hear sermons on communion in a Protestant context that will make that point explicitly. Well, that is just not the Catholic point of view whatsoever at all. And if you come with that disposition, which is a very Protestant way of doing it, then you're not doing communion the Catholic way, regardless of what you believe about the real presence. That for a Catholic, the act of communion is the completion of Christ's act of self-oblation, his offering to the Father on our behalf. And the proper disposition that one brings is not God accepts me without condition, but I offer myself to God without condition. It's my self-oblation. It's my joining myself to that self-sacrificial act of Christ where I make a total gift of myself to Him. And that presupposes contrition, sorrow for sins, a purpose of amendment, the desire to reform my life and live a life of charity, live a life of service, live a life of self-sacrifice, and recognize the dignity of my neighbor, even in the vile and despised person of the alien that I would otherwise be inclined to dislike because of my tribal or racial prejudices or whatever it might be, or my classism, or you name it, or just because he has squeaky boots, right? And to overcome all of that and to put myself at service of the poorest of the poor and the marginalized, as Jesus did, all of that is implied in the Catholic's participation in Holy Communion, which is why St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11 that if you go to Holy Communion when you're at enmity with your neighbor without recognizing the body of Christ in its most broad and expansive sense, not only the sacramental presence of Christ in the consecrated species, but Christ as he exists in my neighbor, in my enemy, right? And if you go without that disposition, you do yourself no good. In fact, you're guilty of sinning against the body and blood of the Lord.
Wow.
And so the Catholic Church recognizes a category, something called sacrilegious communion, which is to go to communion without the proper disposition, without charity, without contrition. And that's a very different conception of what it means to be properly disposed to communion. Now, beyond that, communion is not a simply private act. It's a public act by which I identify with the church community. And in going to communion, I subject myself to the church's jurisdiction. And the church actually has an objective public way of identifying whether or not I'm properly disposed. It's called the confessional, which is another term for the confessional is the tribunal of God's mercy. It has a juridical function to it. The priest is actually judging that I am contrite. And so the priest's word of absolution, not only does it sacramentally absolve me of sin, but it's also a public and authoritative pronouncement that I am fit to go to Holy Communion. Now, St. Paul tells us, do not judge people outside the church. He says that explicitly in 1 Corinthians 5. Don't judge people outside the church. Rather, judge people inside the church. Now, many people think if we tell non-Catholics that they can't go to communion, that the mean old baddie bad Catholic Church is judging them. On the contrary, it's the opposite. The reason we tell them they can't go to communion is precisely because the church says we refuse to judge you. See, we only judge our own. We judge Catholics. And guess what happens if they judge Catholics to be lacking contrition? Don't go to communion.
Yeah.
If I go to the confessional and I say, you know, Father, I did this, this, and this, and this. And he says, well, are you sorry? And I go, well, not really. He'll say, well, when I don't absolve you, you can't go to communion. He's judging me.
Yeah.
Right? He refuses to do that for a non-Catholic. He won't pass judgment on a non-Catholic. And therefore, he has no way to validate that that non-Catholic is properly disposed. So it's literally not safe. I mean, think about like something like chemotherapy. Absolutely life-giving for the person for whom that's the proper medicine. Possibly a death sentence for anybody else.
Yeah.
All right? And imagine if a patient showed up to the pharmacist and said, you know, I'd like chemotherapy, please. The pharmacist says, well, let's see the judgment that this is the right medication for you. Oh, I'm sorry. No, you can't look into my medical charts. And, well, then I can't possibly give you this medication.
Yeah.
Not because I'm judging you, but because you're not letting me judge you. And in the same way, if somebody shows up in the Catholic Church and says, hand me Holy Communion. Okay, let's, you know, when did you submit to the church's tribunal and let us adjudicate whether or not you can safely receive? Well, I'm not doing that. Well, then how can we give it to you safely when Paul himself tells us that this puts you in mortal sin, potentially, if you don't do it right, right?
Yes.
Finally, for a Catholic, the act of going to Holy Communion, St. Paul says that we are all one body because we partake of the one loaf, right? That communion is the sacrament of the church's unity, the sacrament of the church's charity. By going to communion, I'm signaling that I believe that this is a church founded by Christ and I believe all that she teaches. Protestants manifestly don't believe that. And so why would I invite them to perform a ritual action that means something that they don't mean? They absolutely don't mean that they think this is the church that Christ founded. Now, many Protestants get really bent out of shape when Catholics say you can't go to communion. And here's why I think that happens. In Protestant theology, modern Protestant theology, not 16th century Protestants, but modern Protestant theology, conceives of the church as an invisible society of like-minded people that have a relationship with Jesus in their heart, and that the visible distinctions between Protestant denominations are just so many flavors of ice cream, that they don't really matter, and that we're all kind of one big family, and it's all one big thing, and, you know, our little particular differences are just like, you know, you like country, I like Western, we got both kinds of music, you know? They think the meany, baddy Catholic Church says they're not really Christians, because if you reduce the Catholic Church to that conception, right, you just think of the Catholic Church as yet one more denomination, then the Catholic Church's refusal to grant communion to the Protestant makes it seem like the Catholic is saying, well, you're not really Christians, right? But what they're doing is they're really insisting that the Catholic conceive of his own church on the model of a denomination. And that's exactly what we refuse to do. The Catholic position is the Catholic Church was founded by Jesus and is the institution that he set up to be the continuation of his incarnation and his ministry on earth. And so we don't say that non-Catholics are not Christians. We don't make that claim. But we do claim that they're outside of the Catholic Church founded by Jesus.
Right.
It doesn't mean they're outside of redemption, but they are outside of the church that Christ founded. And therefore, we don't agree to reduce the Catholic Church to the model of just yet one more denomination. And that's, I think, one of the reasons that many non-Catholics want communion in the Catholic Church is because they want to feel like, well, we agree with them that it doesn't really matter if you're Catholic or not, we're all just one big happy family. Well, you may be one big happy family, but it does matter whether or not you're Catholic. And so for these and many other reasons together, it's actually a really profound ecclesiological question, who should and should not go to communion. And don't forget, not all Catholics should go to communion. The That's Church right. excludes Catholics from communion if they're not properly disposed. You know, I mean, like, hopefully, if you follow the Church's rules on fasting and abstinence, it may have happened to you one day that you showed up at church and you're like, oh my gosh, I just ate that sausage and biscuit 5 minutes ago, you know, and here we are having this, I better not go to communion. You're not properly disposed because you didn't follow the Church's fast. Or, heaven forbid you're conscious of a grave sin, you're not supposed to go to communion. So communion's not just candy to be handed out willingly to every person.
Well, there you go, Vince. Thanks so much for your call from Phoenix. And David, I caught that Blues Brothers reference that you dropped in there.
The country and Western?
Very slick.
Oh, yeah.
Very slick. Call to communion here on EWTN tomorrow night on EWTN Live with Father Mitch. He's going to welcome Nina Sophie Harriman to discuss what the Bible teaches about the meaning of our gender and God's reason for creating man, woman, and the church, and how the Bible gives us a path through this difficult time. Do check it out, EWTN Live with Father Mitch, tomorrow night, 8 p.m. Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television. We're going to try to get to as many of these calls as we can. For those of you that we cannot get to, you may want to stick around because Open Line Tuesday with Father Wade Meniz is coming up next at 3 p.m. Eastern. So if you want, you can just stay on hold and we'll get to you as quick as we can. Here now is Ken in Portland, Oregon, listening on the great Modern Day Radio. Hello, Ken. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, Dr. Anders. I have a quick question about St. Thomas Aquinas and the Summa. And I kind of know the structure of it, how we ask the question and we get the opposing opinions and then the other side of the opinions. My question is if you get the Summa from an average person gets the Summa and tries to read it, is that advisable, not advisable? Is it a read that somebody can actually understand?
Sure, sure. I appreciate the question a lot. There's definitely a kind of learning curve on being able to approach the Summa and make sense of it. When Thomas writes, he presupposes a certain knowledge of Aristotelian philosophy. And the categories that he uses and applies to almost everything are the categories of Aristotelian logic and metaphysics and epistemology. And so if you lack just a little, you don't need much. You just need a little bit of background in Aristotle. But Thomas is not going to give that to you. He doesn't explain his terms. He just uses the terms and takes for granted that his readers know. Because, of course, he wrote for Dominican students in the 13th century Dominican studia. And so they, of course, did know the terms of Aristotle.
Sure.
And they knew what he was talking about, right? But you have to do a little bit of homework going in. Once you get that homework done, then yes, I think anybody can read the Summa and understand it. So I would recommend, I mean, you can't just pick it up and try and make sense of it. Just recognize that as you do so, you're going to have to put some effort into knowing what he means by these terms that he uses. Now, I think the easiest on-ramp to the Summa that I know of is a book by Edward Faeser, F-E-S-E-R, simply called Aquinas, and that's the title of the book. And Dr. Faeser is going to give you the sort of the philosophical groundwork that you need to make sense of Thomas. Read Faeser's book first, or any other introduction to Thomas, then go pick up the Summa. I won't say you'll have no trouble, but you'll have the tools you need to make sense of it. But I mean, probably the easiest part of the Summa to jump into right off the bat would be maybe the second part of the second part, where Thomas goes into the analysis of particular virtues. And it's just packed full of great stuff. I'm always reading the second part of the second part. You know, if I want to get a handle on what is justice and, you know, why is it wrong to do that? And how many ways can I get wrong doing this? And, I mean, he just lays it out there. And they're very, very helpful. His analysis is usually pretty comprehensive. And that's probably the most approachable part. Most interesting, also the stuff in the sacraments is pretty approachable. Now, the most interesting, philosophically meaty stuff is the first part on God. Caveat emptor.
Yeah, Ken, and a very timely question on your part. Thanks for checking in from Portland. Call to communion here on EWTN. Let's go to the other side of America, to Fort Lauderdale, and talk with Kevin, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Kevin, what's on your mind today, sir? Kevin in Fort Lauderdale, are you there?
Yes, I am. Sorry about that.
That's okay. Go right ahead.
I have a question. I was invited to a wedding where one person is Catholic and the other is Christian. but not Catholic. Uh-huh. My understanding was when two, you know, baptized people, can you hear me?
Yep. Yes.
Two baptized people, you know, commit to each other, given received consent, that it is sacramental, maybe not licit, but sacramental. Is that true or not true? And should I attend that wedding?
All right, let's draw a couple distinctions, okay? We need to distinguish on the one hand between a sacramental marriage and a natural marriage. And then we need to distinguish licit and illicit, and we need to distinguish valid and invalid, okay? Because we're getting our terms confused, and it's causing some difficulty, okay? So a natural marriage is any valid marriage between two non-baptized people. Let me say that again. Any valid marriage between two non-baptized people, or at least one of whom is non-baptized, okay? So, for example, if two Buddhists pledge their union to one another for the sake of raising a family, and they do it in front of a Buddhist clergyman or priest or whatever, that's potentially a valid marriage, but it's a natural marriage. It's not a sacramental marriage. Let's take two baptized people, validly baptized people, who are validly married. They really do get married, okay? Then, by default, two baptized people always achieve a sacramental marriage. But now we have to raise the question of validity. Whether it's natural or sacramental, what is it that makes a marriage valid? Okay? And for a Catholic, no marriage is valid, whether sacramental or otherwise. No marriage is valid, whether sacramental or otherwise, if it is not performed before a Catholic minister, that is a priest or a deacon, or someone designated by the church, or if it lacks a dispensation from one's bishop. So the Catholic has a canonical obligation to marry in the church before a priest, unless he's given specific permission not to. So if there's a Catholic involved, if he marries a Protestant outside the church with permission, then it's valid. If he marries a Protestant outside the church without permission, it's not valid. But remember, the definition of a sacramental marriage is any valid marriage between two baptized people. If it's not valid, it cannot be sacramental. If it's not valid, it cannot be sacramental. Licit just means allowable or not allowable. All right. Sometimes questions of liceity come into play with questions of validity, and sometimes they don't. So to take another sacrament, for example, grandparents should not baptize their grandchildren in the swimming pool when their non-practicing children are not watching. All right. Believe it or not, that happens all the time.
Sure it does.
We get that call all the time. My kid's out of the church. He's not having his children baptized. They came to stay at grandmom's house for the weekend. I baptized them in the bathtub. Is that okay? I get that question. We get that three or four times a year.
Yeah.
Okay. And the church would say, in that instance, not licit is valid. Not licit is valid. All right. But sometimes lacking liceity also causes it to lack validity. And in the case of marriage, that's one of them. It's not licit for a Catholic to marry outside the church, nor is it valid unless he has a dispensation.
Kevin, thanks so much for your call. I think we have enough time here for Kristen in Ohio, listening on her Alexa device. Hey, Kristen, what's on your mind today?
The church used to say that you could vote for a Republican or Democrat just so you don't agree with abortion. And I was wondering, did they change that?
I really appreciate the question. So it's more nuanced than that. The church doesn't really, in her official teaching, doesn't make comments about specific political parties, right? You're not going to get a statement out of the Pope, for example, about the Republican Party, the Democrat Party.
Nope.
What the church does is it lays out a vision of social justice. It teaches this is what a just society looks like, and tells Catholics that they are under an obligation to attempt to seek to bring about a just society with that robust vision. Now, as part of that, obviously, no one can ever vote intentionally for an immoral policy because it's immoral, right? So if a party advocates something that's objectively immoral, I cannot support that policy simply because I want to bring about that immoral thing. Then I'm cooperating with an immoral thing. That could be abortion. That could be genocide. You know, that could be racial segregation or prejudice. I mean, there are all kinds of objectively immoral things, and I shouldn't ever vote for any of them because I'm trying to bring it about. There are occasions when I might vote for a political party that had an immoral item in its platform, if I thought that it was otherwise best suited to bring about that global vision of a just society. But it had better be a pretty darn strong proportionate reason to outweigh something as serious as the sanctity of life, right? And so I'm run out of time. It's just a nuanced question. I don't have time, but you get the idea.
Kristen, thanks so much for your call. Dr. David Anders, thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Tom.
Looking forward to our next program. It's tomorrow right here on EWTN. I'm Tom Price. We will see you then. God bless.